Okay, let's get going. Hour number two. Mitchell Henderson is back tonight. I'm looking forward to hearing Mitch's comments, his opinions, his reactions to today's events. And as Don Jeffries said last hour, you could almost argue that Donald Trump, by appearances, may have accomplished or done more today than he did damn near in 4 years from 2016 to 2020. So, interesting observation. He's off to a running start, it would appear. We will see what happens. This Bible thing is a strange one. Apparently, Roberts began the oath before everyone was ready. Somebody said that. I don't know. But Trump should have stopped him and said, wait a second, we want to get everybody gathered in here and whatever. But he did not. He could have put his hand on the Bible even halfway through. I don't understand what's going on with that. Welcome back, Mitch. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that and many other things that happened today. How goes it?
It's going well, but I did not hear this thing about the Bible. I just kind of jutted in and out of different news things during
right.
the day, but
well,
I did
Chief
not
Justice
see this.
Roberts began the oath, and Melania was holding the Lincoln Bible and the Bible that Trump's mother gave to him when he was a boy. Right there, and he chose not to put his hand on it. He just kept his left hand right at his side, and that was that. So she's still standing there holding the two Bibles. Look it up. It's an odd thing. I don't know what it means. I don't know. It means something. Trump is not stupid. He put his hand on the Bibles the first time around in 2016. So I don't know.
Well, you know what's kind of odd about that is in 2016... nobody would accuse him of being a Christian. But in this campaign, he tried to project himself as a Christian. I even saw him step up his game in that when they asked him in 2016 questions, like they asked him, for example, what's your favorite verse in the Bible? Well, he dissembled. He says, I like every verse in the Bible. I like the whole thing. I like all of it, which is dissembling.
Yeah.
He actually didn't know anything. Okay.
That's correct.
So I noticed in December he gave a little Christian speech, and he had all the talking points that a Christian is supposed to say.
Uh-huh.
Somebody else wrote that for him. He
this
doesn't
was in December?
Know that. He doesn't know it. He doesn't feel it. He just read what somebody else wrote for him.
Agreed.
So that he
Agreed.
Could be said. Well, it wasn't December. I think it was November or October, November. It was sometime in the fall. It was before the election, because he had to go down on record for all the Christian Zionists out there to be the right saying.
I think
the right
there's
thing.
A Zionist okay. angle to this, and that's why he didn't put his hand on it.
I think so,
take.
Too. I think definitely so. So, but tonight I'm going to talk about Trump and China, okay, because he's come in, and the Trump administration is going to focus on China as the major threat to the United States, because it is the largest economic competitor of the United States. Okay, so the objective of U.S. foreign policy is that the United States remains the unipolar power in the world. Russia is the biggest military power, but we know that they have no intention to invade us or invade NATO, so we can move on from any confrontation with them. We do not want to be in a direct war with Russia, because we might lose or be greatly weakened by such a war.
Right.
It is best to remember that what they really want to do is give the appearance of being the most powerful military on Earth. The best way to maintain that appearance is to not have it challenged. The U.S. military spent 20 years in Afghanistan fighting illiterate goat farmers with no superpower support, and were completely defeated. Afghanistan today is governed by the same people that governed in the year 2000. And you know, I have to digress here a little bit, because this is not just an indictment of the entire U.S. military. This is an indictment of some of our best units. So let me tell a personal anecdote, okay? To lead up to what I want to say, what I want to do is I want to talk about a SEAL team operation, okay, and I want to show you what's wrong with it, okay. So in 1985,
did you see the story, Mitch? Did you see the story that there was a claim made that, and I believe it came from Lavrov, that he's saying that the U.S. wants to reinvigorate its military presence in Afghanistan.
I think it's a little bit, Afghanistan kind of showed that we're a paper tiger. It showed the world that we're
a paper tiger. Beyond embarrassing, I agree.
Just trying to project this aura of this appearance of great military power, but we don't have it. And what I want to do is just kind of discuss how you know we don't have it. So I'm going to go back to 1985. I'm going to Officer Candidate School.
Can I do one more thing?
Hold on, go ahead, please.
Let me just make this solid. Lavrov says the U.S. is thinking about reinstating military presence in Afghanistan. Okay? The U.S. is considering the idea of bringing back its military infrastructure to Afghanistan, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said at a meeting of the country's Security Council. We also will not forget about Afghanistan, where the Americans are also trying to reinstate their presence to some extent, using neighboring countries for this purpose. They are thinking of returning their military infrastructure there, he said. The top Russian diplomat said he was referring to the policies of the outgoing U.S. President Biden administration. He's not saying that Trump is going to pick that up and follow, but he said that clearly there were efforts being made after Biden's ignominious disgrace of America when he took over and gave up $85 billion worth of U.S. equipment, walked out, abandoned all kinds of people there. But apparently there were efforts going on in the background to somehow reestablish the U.S. presence there. And that's what I think Lavrov is asking, maybe for Trump to define what his thoughts are on this.
Well, I think so, and I think Trump is unconcerned. Let me tell you what the Biden administration was thinking of. First of all, when the Ukraine war started with Russia, we went in and Imran Khan, the most popular leader Pakistan has ever had, was going to stay pretty neutral and be friendly with Russia. So the United States had him overthrown. Okay. So the next obvious thing after that would be to go back in to Afghanistan so that we have Pakistan and Afghanistan blocking Russia on the south, blocking Iran to the east. Okay. But these were not really well-developed plans. I mean, the CIA overthrew Imran Khan, but then that's it. And still, even after they did that, Pakistan still did business with Russia anyway. So,
got it.
So we weren't as persuasive as we wanted to be. Okay. So the Afghanistan is a good picture of the macrocosm of the failure of the United States, how we mentally drift from things and let things go. And we did, we were trying to make a woke society in a medieval Muslim society. We wanted to transform it to a modern woke society that accepted gay rights and women running the government. Well, that was not going to ever work. Okay, it wasn't going to happen. So that is sort of a mission creep there. We could take Afghanistan down so it wouldn't shelter al-Qaeda, maybe even to have it opposed to Russian influence. But at the time, we were not on unfriendly terms with Russia, so we didn't think of that. Instead, we got carried away with all this trying to impose wokeness or Marxism on them. That's what the Soviet Union tried to impose Marxism on them, and they didn't accept it back in the 70s and early 80s, and they're not going to accept it now, okay? So,
all right, very good.
So, yeah, I think so, but I don't think Trump has any inclination to go back to Afghanistan. I think they know Russia's not a threat, and they're going to just move on because we can't confront them. Okay. So let me explain kind of why, all right? So in 1985, I was in officer candidate school. They have you do this test before you graduate and stuff. You have to do this, it's a practical test. So they give you a mission, and you go on your mission, and they complicate your mission for you to see how you'll react. So what my mission was, it was a long-range reconnaissance patrol. Okay, now these patrols
Mitch, hold on, you just said something. They're going to complicate your mission for you, i.e. make it more dangerous to see how you react?
Just complicate it so that it'll fail. Give me problems that will cause me to fail in my mission. The mission was to go into enemy territory, gather information, and come back out without the enemy knowing that I was there. Okay? That was my mission. So as I'm going along, what they did is they had one of my soldiers, he said, I'm going to refuse to go any further. Okay? Now this puts me in a bind because if I leave him behind, the enemy can find him and it'll compromise my mission. Okay? So they said, well, what are you going to do about this? I said, well, okay, we're going to dig a hole, we're going to put him in it, and we're going to kill him. We're going to bury him so the enemy cannot find him. Then we're either going to destroy and put his weapons in the hole with him, or if some of my other guys want to carry the weapons and ammunition, they can take it with them. That was my solution. That was the correct, not only the correct solution, it was really the only solution. So I wasn't going to compromise my mission by letting one of my soldiers, an American soldier, live. I was going to kill him so that I could complete the mission. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was the correct solution. Let's flash forward to Afghanistan. Four SEALs go up on a mountain in Afghanistan to do reconnaissance. And this is in the movie Lone Survivor, which is not a true movie, okay? What really happened is as follows. So these four SEAL teams, they run into Afghan farmer and his kid. And Lieutenant Michael Murphy says, well, we can't kill civilians. So they let him go, and they brought the other Taliban up to them, and the other Taliban killed everybody except for Marcus Luttrell. Okay, Lieutenant Murphy went to a big rock so he could call for help, which was a big Chinook helicopter coming in, okay? So right there, I want to tell you, that's a problem. He should have killed the farmer and the kid. Just with a knife, you know, silently and stuff, and got him out of the way, because they were compromising the mission. The mission comes first. If I am going to kill an American soldier to protect the mission, he should be willing to kill an Afghan civilian and his kid, okay, to protect the mission. That would have been the right thing to do. Okay, mm-hmm. It was very much the wrong thing to do. So what happened is Lieutenant Murphy and I think two other SEALs were killed, and Marcus Luttrell, he escaped and was not killed. Now, here's a few facts. Okay. Facts are there were four SEALs. Okay. In the movie, they make it like 100 Taliban attacked them. There was only 8 to 12 Taliban attacking them. Only 8 to 12. No Taliban were killed by this team. None. Okay. Only the SEALs died. Okay. Marcus Luttrell himself, when the Afghan farmer found him, he had 11 magazines of ammunition on him, and all the magazines were full. Marcus Luttrell had not shot anybody. Okay. Now, to cover up this terrible, terrible failure of an operation, what the Navy did was they gave Lieutenant Murphy a Medal of Honor. Okay, he does not deserve one. He failed in his mission. He failed his men. He got his men killed. He did not succeed in his mission. Okay, Marcus Luttrell got a Navy Cross. Okay, now here, this is from Marcus Luttrell's mouth himself. He said that after all this happened, the Navy came to him and hooked him up with an author, and they dictated the story the way they wanted it. Okay, wow. He did not tell the story. They created this story and put this up to the public to cover up their failure.
It's probably a fairly common way to deal with things like this, no? Just lie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is just an example of what they did. So I want people to be to just realize that that was an utter failure. Okay, there was nothing heroic that happened that day. Okay, the Taliban were very heroic. They took out four SEALs, right, and compromised the mission. Now, when the helicopter was coming in to rescue them, it got shot down, and all 18 soldiers aboard died. Okay. This was an epic failure of American military force. Epic. Okay. So, and this was covered up. This is a little under a microscope of what happened. And then you look at the big picture of what happened. We did the same thing. The Taliban beat us with no superpower support and no professional army fighting us. Okay. We just gave to them. All right. So let me continue on. When we went to war in Ukraine, we were hoping that we could isolate Russia and win against them in an economic war, the sanctions war. We thought this because we brought the Soviet Union down in an economic war. Reagan's phony Star Wars program caused the Soviet Union to invest in military technology at the expense of consumer goods and basic infrastructure. However, the sanctions war has grievously hurt our allies like Germany and Japan without actually hurting Russia. Russia has shown itself not just to be resilient, but to go on the economic offensive by building new trade and financial structure through BRICS. So Trump is going to go on the economic offensive against China and attempt to cut their economy down to size. Biden's sanctions wars on Russia increased inflation by increasing gas prices that he had already artificially increased by a year before by canceling petroleum drilling in the United States. That inflation was bad enough. Russia's share of the world economy is just 2.23%. Just 2.23%. So the only real effect on the American consumer was in fuel prices. Trump can fix that by approving pipelines and opening up more drilling licenses. However, a sanctions war on China is a major scale-up. China controls 17.86% of the world economy. Okay, that's like 8 times more than Russia. The United States imports from China 15% of its imports. That is a major increase if we pegged it at one-for-one for inflation. However, it will crush our allies even more. 23% of Japanese imports are from China, 23% of South Korea's imports are from China, and 20.5% of the EU's imports are from China. Standing with America definitely impoverishes your nation and increases the cost of living for your citizens. As a matter of fact, if Japan and South Korea drop their alliance with the United States and made good relations with China and Russia, Japanese and Koreans would live their best, most inexpensive lives. China and Russia have no desire to conquer Korea or Japan. North Korea may have designs in South Korea, but for Russia and China, they would rather have great business relations with South Korea and would probably be more effective at preventing North Korea from invading the South. North Korea may be quite placated because there would be no United States threatening them. The U.S. is a very expensive friend to Japan and South Korea in opportunities for wealth and peace lost. The people of Japan realize this. The politicians of Japan and Korea recognize this also. The business people of Japan and South Korea just accept this as a fact. They are acutely aware of the opportunities lost by being friends with America. What America offers, feminism and gay rights, are not something the average Japanese or Korean cares about. They have to pay too high a price for that. Not only that, but neither China nor Russia makes any demands in social policy. They don't care what the Koreans or Japanese do about feminism or gay rights. They can do what they want. It is only America, the Homeowners Association parent of the world, that demands compliance on such social issues. Such issues have terrible effects on Korean society and are not, in fact, values to Japanese culture either. A sanctions war with China will have some effect on the U.S. economy at the beginning, but as our sanctions war pushes China to shift trade to other nations and away from our allies, the dollar and trade relations with the rest of the world will deteriorate for America. The sanctions war alone could crash the world economy. And we're talking about one-fifth of all these nations' economies. This will drag the world economy down. America and China make up 43% of the world economy. That's America and China alone make up 43% of the world economy. There are 8 billion people on Earth. Their lives depend on smoothly running supply chains. Donald Trump and the China hawks he is appointing to his cabinet are going to throw a monkey wrench into that. We will see poverty on a scale greater than the Great Depression of the 1930s. Here at home in the U.S., prices will go up under Trump because he intends to impose tariffs on Chinese, Mexican, and Canadian goods. We import 15% of our imports from China, 16% from Mexico, and 14% from Canada. That is 45% of all our imported goods come from those three nations alone. Prices for consumer goods in America will skyrocket. The Trump administration will still impoverish you, just like the Biden administration. Hopefully, the Trump administration will not want to have sex with your kids. We will see. That'll be the only difference.
Yeah.
Okay. The purpose of tariffs is to make imports more expensive and thereby encourage investment in their production in America. Keep in mind, though, that imports are tied to exports in that if we impose tariffs on other nations, they are likely to impose tariffs on our exports. Once again, this will affect our allies more than China. Only 7.5% of our exports go to China, while 18% go to Canada and 16% to Mexico. That is 41.5% of our exports are going to just these three nations. The industries that produce these exports will have to close factories and lay people off. They can get less paying jobs at the new companies that produce the cheap goods we used to import from those nations. The Trump administration will beg sacrifice and patience because these things will make America stronger and more self-reliant nation. They will make America great again for the power-hungry financial elites, but not for the average citizen who will have to give up financial wealth so that it can be further concentrated into the small elite that already have far more than they can ever use. Why does Trump want to do this? To build a war chest for a war with Iran in order to serve the Zionist state of Israel. The Trump administration is jam-packed with Zionist Christians, and so is the U.S. Congress. The main objective of these religious zealots have is to make Israel great again. Trump has nominated a cabinet full of China war hawks. This should tell you where his focus is. This should also tell you that there are a few people in his administration that understands China or that can properly evaluate China's strengths and weaknesses. It is a closed club that has very little understanding of China and cannot properly evaluate it. They may evaluate something as weak only because they cannot understand it in the proper context. Why do they say China is our greatest threat? In my long life and many years as a vice cop, I noticed something. Men who cheat on their wives tend to think that their wives are cheating on them. In the same way, countries that want to intervene and invade other countries tend to think that other countries want to invade them. Because we want to invade Russia and China and want them to obey us and think and do as we say, we will always believe in our hearts that they want to do the same to us. They believe Russia and China want to invade us. We believe this regardless of how untrue and how absurd it is. So for an in-depth look at China from the Chinese point of view, look at Chapter 9 in my book, The Final Wars, How to Survive the Coming Civil War in America, World War III, and the Collapse of Civilization, available on Amazon. You can type my name, Mitchell Henderson, in The Final Wars, and it'll come up. Chapter 9 is very important for understanding what's going on in the world. It very much applies to the Trump presidency also. Okay? So to understand China and its military, let's see how it works. China is the oldest empire on Earth. China has been a country for 4,874 years without a break. America has only been a country for 248 years. China has stronger traditions than we do. It has only ever wanted to rule China. It has never been an expansionist empire. The right to rule was never about military power in China. It was always about moral force or the mandate of heaven. A king became king not because he had military or political power, but because he could do the people good and improve their lives. Make no mistake, once in power, power had to be protected with political and military force. Bad times meant that the king lost his moral force, and he deserved to be deposed. Even today, the Chinese Communist Party must perform and improve the people's lives if it expects to remain in power. It is not war that makes a Chinese leader great. It is peace and prosperity. Realize this, people. What Chairman Xi is thinking about is peace and prosperity. He wants to do business with us. He does not want to go war with us.
Well,
war
look at,
with
and
us
look what's happening with TikTok. Trump is talking with Xi right now about taking half ownership of TikTok to allow it to continue operating in the U.S. That's his deal, the deal maker. We don't know how China's responding to that so far, but 130 million
Americans.
Well,
you know, a lot
Americans
of people have woken
TikTok
up to the concept
like that
they tried to say TikTok gathers information from American consumers. Well, of course they do, as do all social media. Same information from you. When they ask people, would you rather the United States government have that information, or would you rather have the Chinese government have that information? I don't know about you, but I would rather have the Chinese government have that information because they're far away and they're not going to come and bother me about anything.
I agree. Okay? That's good.
So China is the oldest continual nation on Earth because peace and prosperity is their objective. Not obtaining power for the ruling class. Not by being the homeowner association Karen of their neighborhood or the world. China has never attempted to control their neighborhood nor the world. China has always just concentrated itself with and concerned itself with China and the Chinese. But how is China organized? Their traditional organization gives clues to how they see the world and the problems with their military. Okay, so I'm going to read this from a book called The History of the Ancient World by Susan Weiss Bauer from page 262. Okay, and this is a quote. This suggests a great deal of autocratic authority on the part of the king, particularly since he was able to compel death even after his own. Yet Sima Qian also makes constant mention of court officials and ruling noblemen with clout of their own. Properly, the area over which the Shang king exercised his imperiousness was fairly small. On the edges of this, his nobles and officials governed in his name, but acted more or less as they pleased. The Shang king was the spiritual head of all his people, but the real and earthly power existed inside a much smaller domain. The king, his spiritual virtues notwithstanding, had to rely on others to carry out the governing of his people, not just the sage assistants, but also the noblemen who were actually in control of those further-flung provinces of the Shang kingdom. End quote. The old Chinese aphorism about personal liberty reflects this. The mountains are high and the emperor is far away. This verse allows you to understand how China is organized, why China has trouble with India, and why Chairman Xi is reorganizing the People's Liberation Army. In China today, Chairman Xi is like the emperor, but the provincial governors have real power. In the same way, military commanders in the provinces have real power and are expected to take initiative. This is true to the brigade commander, especially on the borders. Because communications have been traditionally slow across the vast expanse of China, PLA brigade commanders on the border were given great leeway and initiative to defend China without first getting permission from Peking. This occurred in 2020 in the Aksai Chin area on the border with India. A local regimental border defense regiment ran into an Indian patrol quite by accident, and the commander overreacted to the situation and made and opened up on the Indian forces. Keep in mind that the Indian Army is a well-trained institution. What happened next was not any decision by higher command, but the execution of a contingency plan, sort of a mind-of-its-own automatic response, bringing several PLA divisions from Xinjiang down onto the border, sort of a reflexive response. This turned into a four-year incident lasting from 2020 to 2024. The important thing is that this was not ordered or even approved by Peking or Chairman Xi. This was the way the Chinese army always acted due to poor communications on the borderlands. Once it happened, Chairman Xi gave it the party's imprimatur. This demonstrated to the PLA that the chairman and the party had the soldiers' back. But it was also a revolution in the PLA because Peking was able, with modern communications, to begin to bring the brigade commanders more into centralized command. This was established and solidified by 2024. This was the party and the PLA establishing unity of command through effective command and control without hurting the encouragement of initiative by local commanders on the fringes of the nation. This was important because China needs to have good relations with India, a fellow BRICS member, so they really do need to avoid military clashes on the India border. Better command and control can achieve that. An in-depth evaluation of the PLA action on the India border was published in the December 9, 2024 issue of the Texas National Security Review, written by Shanshan Mei and Dennis J. Blasco. Blasco was a military attaché in Peking when I first went to China, worked in China in 1996. He's very knowledgeable about the People's Liberation Army, and they have good sources in the PLA. So this is what they said in this journal article. Okay, so what the PLA operation along India's border achieved was as follows. First, it boosted the morale of the PLA soldiers on the ground. That's because when they had to get in a fight, they backed up their soldiers instead of throwing them under the bus. Two, it allowed the PLA staff to evaluate the efficacy of small unit leadership, organizational and doctrinal reforms, and new weapons. It allowed the PLA to identify shortcomings in deployment, operations, and sustain them. Three, the PLA learned how to improve wartime command and control for geographically dispersed, forwardly deployed units in challenging environments under degraded communications conditions. It was those degraded communications conditions that necessitated the broad freedom and initiative of the regimental commander that led to conflict that they did not want. To be clear, the regimental commander was not punished. His superiors had his back. But this incident helped develop the command and control where another unwanted incident like this would not occur again. I kind of admire the PLA leaders for not throwing this commander under the bus. They know he is a good and capable commander. In the U.S. military under Biden, he probably would have gone to prison. Let me reiterate that this development is important to China's foreign relations and its military development. Four, the PLA logistics system has proven its ability to deploy, maintain, and sustain a large dispersed force at extreme altitudes for multiple years. This showed their ability to use road and rail transport as well as the air and sea transportation used along the Taiwan Straits and South China Sea. 5. New weapons and technologies have been integrated into the PLA's including communications, construction engineering, observation and intelligence, and medical support. I have seen some other assessments that sort of belittle the PLA based on a misunderstanding of culture. For example, I've seen where people think the PLA are dorks because their military orders read like poetry. Poetry is a method of both motivation and memorizing. European armies have always and traditionally used music to motivate troops. They used to even use music while marching into battle. It motivates U.S. aircraft troops going into battle with Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries playing on loudspeakers like in the movie Apocalypse Now. Mm. Once in the police department, we did a coordinated raid on a large building in Tampa to clean out a gang. We played the same song on a loudspeaker while we raided the building. So this is something that we do in the West, okay? Americans are motivated by music. Chinese are motivated by poetry. For several millennia, the civil service exams in China were based on knowing the poetry in the five classics, which were the Book of Odes, the Book of Documents, the Book of Changes, the Book of Rites, and the Spring and Autumn Annals. Right. Poetry is as Chinese as McDonald's cheeseburgers are to Americans. Not only does poetry motivate the Chinese soul, it also helps in memorizing. Orders are written poetically so everyone can remember them. American soldiers memorize by mnemonics, Chinese with poetry. As an officer, I use the mnemonic MET-T, both to organize an operation and organize orders. It means mission, enemy, terrain, troops, and time. And all Army officers do this, all of them, okay? To issue orders, the U.S. Army uses the mnemonic SMEAC, which stands for Situation, Mission, Execution, Administration, Logistics, Command, and Signal. Frankly, I would find the poetry more inspiring. The way the PLA issues orders is what is best for Chinese people, and since the PLA is made up of Chinese people, it is the best and logistical fit for them. It's not something we can condescendingly look down upon them for. It is their way of doing things, okay? It is the best for them. It may not work with the American Army, but it works with the People's Liberation Army. Remember, what looks like disorganization to us is effective organization to the Chinese. The Chinese see our way as disorganized and inefficient, but it works for America. Also, you can look at the structure of a military force and see what it is built for. The Chinese People's Liberation Army is designed for defense. It is not made for projecting power. The Russian Army is designed for defense. It is not made for projecting power. The United States Army is designed for projecting power, and it has almost no focus on defense. We don't have a military to defend us. We have an offensive military. Okay? They're not even thinking it. Defense is left to the National Guard and the State Guards or militias. Okay, the Trump administration is going to tell you that the biggest threat to America is China. China has no desire or plans to attack us. They never have in their history. And this is one country for 4,800 years. Okay, China has never attacked the United States.
Who's stirring up the pot? Who's putting the stories out there that China is
it's the military-industrial complex. It's the same
looking
people.
Looking for money. Same thing.
Yeah, it's the same people. You know, if you want to spend money on military weapon, you got to instill fear. Okay, so let me ask you this question, okay? Has the United States attacked and occupied China? Now, China has never attacked and occupied America, but have we attacked and occupied them? The first time in 1856 in the Battle of the Barrier Forts during the First Opium Wars, we attacked. That was to protect the Delano and Forbes families who wanted to sell Turkish opium in China. This is Franklin Roosevelt's mother's family, by the way. and like Steve Forbes, the Forbes family, Forbes Fortune, these people made their money from selling drugs. They're drug smugglers. Okay. So 1867, we sent a punitive expedition to Taiwan. 1874, anti-piracy patrol on the Yangtze River. 1899 to 1901, the Boxer Rebellion. We sent troops to make the government behave the way we wanted them to. 1902 through 1942, U.S. Navy, U.S. Marine patrols on the Yangtze River to attack bandits, pirates, and protect American lives, property, and business interests. This is a river inside China. We patrol it. 1942 to 1945, we were allied with Chinese forces against the Japanese. Mm-hmm. 1945 to 1949, Operation Beleaguer. U.S. Navy and Marines occupied Hebei and Shandong Province. My father was part of this. He was stationed in Shanghai and Tsingtao in the U.S. Navy during those years. 1954 through 79, U.S. forces were stationed in Taiwan, recognized as a part of China. 1954 to 55 and 1958, the Taiwan Straits incidents, U.S. Navy was in combat with Chinese forces. Hmm. In 2021, there were 24 U.S. troops stationed in Taiwan, internationally recognized as Chinese soil. In 2022, there were 30 U.S. troops stationed in Taiwan. In 2023 to present, there are 200 U.S. troops stationed in Taiwan, including on Tianmen Island, just 1 mile off China's mainland. The United States either invaded or occupied Chinese soil for 79 years and counting.
Wow. Yeah.
My father was stationed in Tsingtao in Shanghai, China, with the occupation forces in 1946. Even I was stationed temporarily in China, in Taipei, in 1973. Honestly, China has much to fear from us, and we have nothing to fear from them. No Chinese soldier has ever invaded or occupied American soil. There are no Chinese soldiers stationed just 1 mile away from America. Is China sending fifth columnists to America? Definitely. If we go to war with China, these Chinese legal and illegal immigrants will sabotage American infrastructure and disrupt transportation and communications. There are over 600 separate Chinese communist organizations in the United States of which Chinese immigrants are members of. That many of these Chinese immigrants are seeking asylum begs the question, asylum from what, since many join these CCP cells when they arrive. It's like the Chinese Communist Association of Boston and stuff. What the hell? Are they really running from Chinese communism? They are not here to conquer, to take over. They are here to disrupt and interfere. So, I just wanted to kind of give you some keys to evaluating this rhetoric.
Let me summarize this. You do not fear China attacking the U.S. unless we were to provoke something and they would have to respond. They just yes. Not going to happen. How about Taiwan? Yes. What about Taiwan? What are your guesses
Taiwan
about
Taiwan belongs
that?
To China. That's Chinese territory. What are we doing there? I'll tell you what we're doing there, and I say this in my book, in the mm-hmm. Final Wars. What we're doing there is we're the Homeowner Association caring. Taiwan gives us a base by which we can interfere in China's affairs, and we can preach to them and we can pressure them. That is what we're doing there. We're there to create problems, okay? Who's going to pay for this? It'll be the Taiwanese people that suffer the consequences of American uh-huh. action, okay? They're the ones who will have to pay. Once again, would China invade Taiwan, make a big war over Taiwan, but they do mm-hmm. that just to do it. No, because once again, what is good for China is peace and prosperity. The mainland was happy doing business with Taiwan. They're major trade partners. They're happy doing business with them. Okay, but what they don't want, the one who's aggravating the situation is American foreign policy. Okay. Neither Taiwan nor mainland China want a war with each other. That is a fiction that we create in America. Our government.
So does this go Hong Kong? What happens?
Well, Hong Kong and Macau were European colonies, and what happened in Hong Kong and Macau was Great Britain and Portugal just turned them back over to mainland China. Okay, so
I see.
Now they made some deals about how they're going to be governed and stuff. Okay, mm-hmm. But here we are. Like I was in Hong Kong the year before they went back to China, and actually, what's the real difference? If you're not into social and cultural causes and stuff like that, like gay rights and feminism and stuff, Hong Kong hasn't changed for you, and neither has Macau. Macau was a gambling capital of Asia back in 1996 and 7 when I was there. Right now, it is the gambling capital of Asia. Gambling is not permitted in China. Okay, so they have not imposed that. What are businesses like in Hong Kong today? Businesses are still running business like they did before. Okay. So, you know, in the daily life of the person in Hong Kong, what has the difference been between British rule and Chinese rule? Well, under British rule, they could advocate for gay rights and feminism and stuff like that. Okay, well, they can't do that under the Chinese. Okay, I mean, listen, we had a Biden administration that we could advocate for gay rights, tranny rights, and all that kind of stuff. But you know what? What did that have to do with me? I didn't appreciate that. I did not appreciate them trying to teach my grandchildren about anal sex in third grade. I did not appreciate that. So what have we lost by losing Biden?
What, 163-pound tumor? Political tumor?
Right, exactly. That's all we've lost, okay? So if you look at the daily lives of the people in Hong Kong, it hasn't changed much. The daily life of people in Macau has not changed much, okay? So what were they? Taiwan is a different case, okay? Uh-huh. What would they have done? Well, did they have to do anything at all? Okay, they didn't have to do anything at all, as long as Taiwan admitted they were part of China, which they do officially, okay, then there was no problem. Listen, back in the 1955 when they had the Taiwan Straits incident, do you know what caused that? What caused that is the president of Taiwan wanted to go back to New Hampshire to visit his alumni where he went to college.
Oh,
and
funny.
That's why the Chinese raised hell. Okay.
Yeah.
So nothing's changed. Okay.
That's funny. That's odd. People.
The Chinese have never ruled or occupied the United States. But listen, in my lifetime, well, not in my lifetime, before my lifetime, and in my lifetime, my father was a U.S. military person on the Chinese mainland, and I went to China in 1973 as a military person. So who's the bad guy here? And should we believe these threats?
Yeah.
I mean, even look at the history of China. China's the same state. Look at their history. The guy stays in power. The people in power stay in power by providing peace and prosperity for Chinese people.
Okay. Uh-huh. Gotcha. Yeah.
So I'm just trying to group people in to not believe their lies.
Is the Trump regime going to be able to hold off the military-industrial complex, the MIC group? They're going to be able to hold them off? It seems like they want nothing but trouble wherever they go because they win. We're in over 150 countries militarily. Panama is now saying, well, you know Central America very well. Panama is saying they'll fight. They will not give up the canal. Now, that's a business. It's not property we're talking about. So that's my understanding of it anyway. Real quick,
well, Panama. We used to have the Panama Canal zone, which was American territory.
Okay. It was
even in the Army in Panama back in 1989 and stuff. So, okay. You know, we had military bases there. And,
so what happens?
And the government had to do what we wanted to do, you know.
Yeah.
So it had to be an American approved government.
Do we take the canal back? What happens?
I don't know. I think a lot of that, Jeff, is bluster. Okay, because remember, Trump is trying to act like the insane man that's unpredictable and stuff. This is part of his negotiating with other countries. He wants to look unreasonable and unpredictable.
So it's his geopolitical media persona.
Is he going to really do it?
Well, we'll find out.
I don't think he'll really do it.
We'll find out. I don't think he's going to make the decision, quite frankly. I think there are much more powerful people involved here.
Well, I think that the thing we have to keep our eye on is what Trump is going to do. Remember I said this before the election. If Trump comes to power, we're still going to be in World War III, but this World War III will involve Israel and Iran, and we're building up to that right now. Everybody that Trump put into power in Washington, D.C., is a Zionist. Everybody is.
Yes, sir. Okay? You got it. Absolutely.
So, there's nobody that speaks against it. Okay.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. Mitchell, thanks for the backdrop on that. Very important. Let's see what happens. We'll talk to you next week. You be safe out there.
Okay, you too. And good night, everybody.
Good night, Mitch. All right, and we'll pause and come right back. Next hour, remote viewing with Dick Allgaier and Edward Reardon. Some very interesting material just ahead. Stay right there.